listeners, you are listening to Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180 AM. This is Zach. Steve's with me. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing good.
Excelente, excelente. What's new?
Sunshine in Seattle. We love it.
Yeah,
you
right.
know, we love sunshine in Seattle.
We think it's sunshine in Seattle.
So if you guys are listening to this show and it's raining in New England, we're used to it.
Yeah, we're used to it. It's sunny. We live in Seattle, but we complain about the rain. But hey, it's somewhat sunny today, whatever day we're recording.
Well, we've got a great guest today, too, even, you know, another exciting story.
Another exciting story. In fact, do you want to go ahead and introduce Charles?
Well, when I first met Charles Herrick, you know, I was impressed with his background and his career as a IBM senior manager, executive leader, and the work that he did in developing leaders and managers in that system, and then demonstrated it and did it in other organizations outside of IBM. But then when he told me about his world records or near world records, you know, as a runner in the 200K and the 400K for his age class, silver medalist. And then when he told me about all the books that he's written and, you know, demonstrated that he can write 10,000 words of salient quality content in the same time that most people scratch their head, and then told me about his background in Africa as a non-licensed medical practitioner. I hope we can say that on the air, Charles.
Yeah.
If not,
he's
a non-licensed medical practitioner that basically stopped an epidemic in a village while he was waiting for the doctors to show up and turn the health care of that whole African village around. I mean, I thought, we got to have this guy on the show.
I know. Charles, and you're in the studio with us, so we're thankful. We're glad you're here.
Well, I'm looking forward to spending some time telling you all about not only Africa, but India. And
awesome.
And fun
awesome.
Stuff.
And a great, humble man. Like, I was reading your profile before the interview, and I'm like, are we interviewing a deity today? I'm like, what is going on?
Well, he told you I'm a writer, and I can make it sound really
excellent. Well, when he's not running the 200K and the 400K, you know, well, that's not the K. That's the meters, right? 200 meters and 400 Ks are even long. If it was a 400K, that would be one long race.
That's
no,
awesome.
when I run longer than a minute, it seems like something cruel. Something God didn't intend.
Well, and even funny, too, we didn't mention, not funny, but great, is 39-year marriage to your best friend. Tell us about your wife.
Christy?
Yeah.
She's just the most wonderful person on earth.
Yeah.
I stole her from a friend who was on a blind date with her. He was striking out pretty bad. He agreed to the deal.
Nice.
But she's just a wonderful person. We've got three kids, and we live in a wonderful home over on Pine Lake in Sammamish, and we've become best friends. We just do everything together, and we just can't get enough spending time with one another.
It's a wonderful, wonderful story.
So, Charles, give us some background. I mean, start with your career at IBM, because our business leaders want to hear that straight up, and tell us all about everything that I just talked about in your own context so that folks can get a feel for where we're going with the deeper questions.
Sure. Well, my career at IBM was never intended to be a career. I was a pre-med student at the university, and my wife had our first child right about the time I was supposed to take the medical college admission test, and so I wanted to find a place to work, and I ended up going to work for IBM. What ended up happening, though, was I got into a culture that was a phenomenal culture. The founder of IBM had gone about making sure that everybody had pride in the company, and he put people first, and it was one of those things where you're part of a successful operation and you feel really, really good about things. And so I kept planning to quit and go to medical school, and then they kept promoting me, and they moved me around the country. I think I made four moves in 5 years, and ultimately ended up running the consulting group for IBM here in Seattle. With IBM in the position it was in the 70s, where they were in every single account, they were the dominant force in the industry. You wonder, how could they keep that momentum going? And what it was is they instilled within managers the requirement that you have to lead. And so it was a very well-led company with a strong culture that went after taking care of individuals. And so I stayed there. I was there for 17 years, And then I decided it was time to go. The company was changing. It changed even more after I left. And I went off and ran a coffee company for a while. And that was a lot of fun.
Austin Chase Coffee.
Austin Chase Coffee. And yeah. we sold that to Cafe Appassionato. It was one, when I took over, it was one store and it was struggling and losing money. And after a while, we did really, really well. In the course of getting the company turned around, and about the time it was just starting to gush cash, it burned to the ground and wiped out about $4 million worth of other businesses.
Oh.
And so I got to deal with lawyers and bankers and all the other fun things. But we got it back going back again. We increased our wholesaling. We ended up with 11 stores, sold it to Cafe Appassionato, and then I went back into the technology industry as ended up working for Best Consulting, which had about 700 people at the time I took over. We doubled in size in the course of 2 years. We'd gone from 0% growth to 74% growth.
Excellent.
And then we tripled our profits. And then I went off and started my own company, Herrick Douglas. It was me and Bill in my living room, and all of a sudden there were 400 of us 2 years later.
Wow.
Sold that off and then did a little bit of private consulting for a while. And then I had an opportunity to go to Africa. They had, a medical team had just gone into this completely remote village. No electricity, no running water, a lot of health issues. And Dr. A, who's the head of surgery over at Swedish, and some nurses and some water specialists went into this remote village and built a temporary little medical clinic and were absolutely overwhelmed.
Mm.
They expected 50, 60, 70 people to show up, and 1,000 people showed up first day, some of which were, some died in line.
Wow.
And it was really rough. They went away to a huge Christian hospital and asked them if they would build a medical clinic there. So this village is in trouble. There's 7,000 people. And what ended up happening was the big hospital said, well, if you can get a business going or something like that, it's a subsistence village. If there isn't some economy of some kind, you're just not going to have the buy-in that you need. So they came back and they decided to put together a team of people, and they wanted somebody that had business skills and financial skills and distribution skills, and but also construction, mechanical, and on and on and on. And when they were looking at it, one guy said, well, we've got this new guy here that seems to have all those skills, and I know he learns languages really quickly. Why don't we ask him to head the thing up? And what ended up happening was I said, well, the situation sounds dire. Why don't I just go myself? And so I went alone into that village.
Wow.
With the idea of trying to establish a some type of little mini business. And
but you were the new guy who learned languages really well, right?
Right, right.
How many languages do you
I've learned over the course of the years. You learn them, then if you don't use them, you start to lose them. But Latin, German, Spanish, Romanian, Arabic, Swahili, and between those, it was enough to get around.
And then there's English.
Yeah.
Okay. Go back to the story. I want to make sure everybody knew it was you.
We've got the best language. So what happened was over one weekend, about 11 people died within about 75 yards of me.
Wow.
And it was all of different things. Even though the village was 40% HIV, none of these people had died of AIDS. And so what I decided was, it was very much like when you go in and do a consulting job, and you go in a company, and if they'll tell you, oh, well, we've got this problem and this problem. When it gets to about 17, you realize they don't have 17 problems. They got one.
Right.
And I felt that there was something underlying all of this. So I kind of abandoned the business side and put on my old health sciences hat and did the etiological work. And I kept trying to beg doctors to come into the village. I was the only one that had a car. And I would go off and I'd talk to them and say, can you come in here? And I'd tell them, this is what I'm dealing with. And they'd say, oh, that's gangrene. She will be dead. Mm-hmm. And so nobody would go in, because doctors only get paid $250 a year there, and a teacher makes $150, so
wow.
They had no incentive to go into a village like this one, which was dangerous.
Yeah.
Witch doctors and all the other things they were dealing with. What ended up happening was I just started treating people myself, and I would drive into Kisumu, which is a couple hours away, and I'd say, you know, here's what I'm dealing with, and I'd bring back medications to treat as many as 40 or 50 at a time. And every person I treated lived, including the girl with gas gangrene, but pneumonia, all these other things. And at that point, I finally figured out they have some terrible habits there. They shake hands. Even husband and wife shake hands. They don't kiss. Yeah. And what I saw was people were passing around something. And I finally decided it was something like a pinworm, a nematode worm. And I went to the director of Ministry of Health, and I told him I was doing something illegal. And it's a serious crime, actually, to practice medicine without a license in Kenya. But since I couldn't get doctors in, what was I going to do? Watch people die.
Right.
And so... he said, "Hey, don't worry about that. Tell me about this. What your conclusions are." And so I gave him kind of an IBM style presentation in the middle of his funny little office, and he agreed with me. And he said, "Our problem is if we announce it to the village, they will immediately, the forces of corruption will start, and they will try to get a hold of medicine." So what he did was he waited, and this is I finally had to leave the country, but. They waited, and they went in as a team, and they had a little ceremony, and then they went and they wormed every single, all 7,000 people in that village, and then they came back 3 months later and 3 months later, and so they did it four times, and they essentially eradicated the disease that was killing at least 200 or 300 people a year.
Wow.
And so it was wow. Really fulfilling to be able to do that.
Wow.
That was amazing.
Wow. So we want to hear about your career as a track and field star and a runner. But what we really want to hear about, and what our listeners especially want to hear about, is how you were able to develop so many leaders and so many managers in the process of deploying not just what you learned at IBM, but what you learned in turning around and this phenomenal growth in these three companies that you ran.
Sure.
Tell us about that.
We're going to do that right after the break. So that was the clincher.
Why do you always do the breaks?
Because I'm looking at the clock. All right, we'll be right back. You're listening to Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180. We have a fabulous guest, Charles Herrick. We'll be right back.
Remember Ross Perot, the Texas millionaire who ran for president in the early 90s? Did you realize that he's built multiple companies that sold for billions? Each of his companies held a strong values-based culture. We interviewed his CFO and COO. His insightful comments on the role of culture in business are posted on the Culture News blog at excellentcultures.com. Take a look. You'll gain wonderful insights to building your own excellent cultures on excellentcultures.com. You can also follow us at XLNTCultures or Facebook/Excellent Cultures.
Off-the-cuff management is old school at the very least. With culture at the root of every business problem or success, data-driven strategic leadership is where today's best businesses are focused. No one knows that better than Excellent Cultures. After 35 years, they are the Northwest's premier strategic leadership firm. Excellent Cultures has the expertise to read the soul of your business and generate abundance. Take the free Biz Culture MRI or ask the experts at excellentcultures.com.
As an executive, CEO, or business owner, do you find yourself struggling with work-life balance and achieving your goals at work and home? Are you overwhelmed in your workload and feel important things aren't getting done? Our coaches specialize in helping leaders like you overcome challenges and build a plan to recenter their life, to achieve the balance and success you've always hoped for in your business and your personal life. Ask the experts at Excellent Cultures about the right plan for you.
And we're back. Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180. We're with Charles Herrick. Steve, lead us back into what you were so upset that we had to take a break
before
over.
Before the break, I'm sitting here hearing all these leadership and culture skills and all this stuff that's just oozing out of Charles as he tells his story.
In the midst of Kenya and disease and helping people.
And breaking laws to save lives.
Right.
And putting his own life on the line and all of these wild and crazy things he's done. But what's so cool is Charles has figured out a way to translate all of these leadership components and practices and processes into a program that you kind of developed in turning these businesses around. as you did it, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was just talking to a couple of other ex-IBMers who had gone into the middle management ranks as I had, and we were all talking about the fact that we didn't realize what we had at IBM. You know, they made us go off for management training every single year, and you know, that was not something you were excited about. Once you get out and once you see what's out there and you realize that the majority of the companies have abandoned anything other than maybe legal training or something of that nature, or, you know, go out in the woods and, you know, catch each other when you fall, that type of training.
No more leadership 101 unless you're in the military service.
Right, right. Or just the fundamentals of management, hiring and firing, and, you know, how do you handle crisis situations? How do you communicate? How do you delegate? All those other things. And so when I came back almost reluctantly to the company I was telling you about, Best Consulting, it had 700 people and about 280 people here in the Seattle area. And the growth was zero. It had gone from 10% growth down to zero growth. It just couldn't keep up. It was losing as many people as it was bringing on board. They didn't have a management culture. And morale was just absolutely terrible. And I knew that if I was going to get anything done, I had to have a management team that was on board and capable of getting this thing done. How do you come up with a vision or a strategy or anything else like that if you can't translate it? Your management team is your transmission. And so, and I see today even companies with these great big engines and these great big fat tires like a dragster, and then they've got this kind of Renault transmission in the middle that can't get them where they want to go. So when I realized none of the managers, other than maybe by chance, had any type of management training, I essentially took and condensed into a very short class the management training that I had at IBM. And the idea was get people so that they know the difference between being a boss and a manager. So that they learn.
Big difference, by the way.
Huge difference. And, you know, a taskmaster gets things done because he's got the whip and the gun. A leader gets things done because people actually want to do what he's trying to get them to do. And so if you don't have those skills, then you have a problem. What I saw was a really serious problem with morale. And if you look at morale, it comes down to only two components. People like to find all kinds of different things, but it's really two and only two components. Do people believe that the company is going to be safe? It's going to be successful. If it's successful now, will it continue to be successful? If it's not doing so good now, are we going to do something to get it going? Okay, so if people believe the ship's going to get into port safely, that's one component. The second component is, are the managers carrying out the three utility functions of management?
Which are?
They are communication, true delegation, and recognition of performance. And if you're not doing those all the time, then gaps certainly occur, and all of a sudden you have kind of a weak situation. So is the company going to succeed, and is management doing its job? Those are the only two components. And when that's not there, then you have a low morale, and that's exactly what we had at Best. And so I did reorganize the company to a lot of inefficiencies in the way it was organized, and then I trained every single manager, not only the ones I have, but in the future, every single other manager. And we grew again. We had 1,500 employees by the time I left. Every single manager that came on board had to go through a class, and I personally taught that class. And it was based on IBM training with a little bit of additional twist that I've added, because I felt that IBM in some respects hadn't gone far enough. Mm-hmm. They essentially had a version of the golden rule, and I felt that you had to also take into consideration the fact that we're kind of tribal creatures, and people want to know that they're going to be safe. They want to know that they're going to get their chance to tell their story. They want to know that they're being led by noble managers. And so you have to do some additional things to make sure that is instituted within your organization. So that was the training that I put together. I then went beyond, because you've got to know if your managers are doing a good job. I mean, they'll tell you anecdotally that they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you'll kind of sense maybe they are, maybe they aren't, but, you know, managing by sense is sometimes good. There was a thing that we had to do at IBM, which was kind of interesting. You couldn't be a manager for more than 30 days without going off to new manager school. So you go back and you realize, to your horror, how far off you are from being a good manager. Then by the time you're there for 6 months, you have to go back for your second new manager school. What they don't tell you is, about a week before you head back, your secretary walks in, hands you a little survey to fill out about yourself. And she has the identical survey with slightly different wording that your employees fill about you. And then your manager fills that one out, one for himself about you.
So a 360
review. It's essentially a 360, and it's really revealing. You then go back and compare, and you find out, you know, what it is, where you've got to improve. And I wanted to see the same thing. And then the final element is, how's the company itself doing? And once a year, IBM had an opinion survey, and it was about 50-some questions with a built-in morale index that would ask critical questions, and you knew where you had a problem. And your managers know where they've got to improve. You know, as a company, where you got to improve. But I mean, fundamental things. You need to know, do your employees right. feel safe coming to work? Do they feel like they're being well led? Do they feel like they're being paid equivalent to the rest of the people in the industry? You've got to know these things, and then you can say, okay, now what are we going to do?
So, like an employee satisfaction, employee engagement kind of a survey.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Can we jump back really quick? I mean, all of this is and sounds basic, fundamental, multiplying leaders, training people. Right. Why have companies gone away from doing that?
Yeah.
In your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. There was a period of time. I remember when I first went to work at IBM, and kind of an old timer said to me, he said, the thing to keep in mind now is, when your boss says jump, you say how high. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine saying that to a Gen X or a Gen Y type?
It's not. You could say that to me, and yeah, I'm going to be like, I'm going to jump nowhere near you.
Yeah. I'm going to jump on you and not get off you until you say uncle.
I wrote a famous memo. It was called the Gen X memo. Yeah. It was to my managers, because I was going nuts. These guys didn't get it. And one of the things I said was, you know, don't manage them on the little stuff. I mean, no. These guys will sleep in their car before they'll lose their job, lose their money, and sleep in a car before they'll go to work for a jerk again.
Yep.
And so don't do that. So what happened was, authority sort of became an uncool thing. And, you know, Bill Gates did some great things by telling people not to wear a suit when they're writing code. But okay, so you're going to get rid of a whole bunch of stuff. What are you going to replace it with? Yeah. And I think it got replaced with a little of anarchy. Mm. And I can tell you, I was at Microsoft throughout their early days, and it was, to a degree, anarchy. It's gotten much, much better. Mm-hmm. But the idea of celebrating, in any respect, management was somehow became, that's not cool.
Yeah.
And the problem is, going back to it, how do you transmit anything if your managers aren't doing a good job? And I believe you're exposed legally as well.
Yeah.
So
you've got to have very, very good managers to get the job.
Yeah, so we have lots of clients, and I'm sure there's tons of listeners who have lots of managers in their firm. And today, where managers seem to come from, and more than any place else, and really this is small, middle, and huge companies, are someone who performs well in right. sales, or someone who performs well, you know, on the manufacturing line, or someone who just distinguishes themselves as a high performer. So today you are a manager,
right.
And then they're scratching their heads saying, well, okay, so what do I do? I mean, what advice do you have for companies and firms that do that?
Right, and the first thing you look for in managers is, do they have management skills or the potential for developing management skills? And if all they are is they were the best salesperson, they're somehow going to magically turn everybody else into the best salesman. That's not how it works.
Yeah.
Management's a profession, and you've got to develop people so that they operate. It's you know, like most professions, like most anything you learn, whether it's how to hold a tennis racket or, you know, how to charge a machine gun nest, you're doing things that are counterintuitive, at least to begin with. And you have to learn what those counterintuitive things are, how they come up, and then how you as a manager deal with them. Otherwise, You'll be dealing in personalities when you should be dealing in business issues. You'll be focusing on how all the time and driving people nuts instead of doing a really good job of figuring out here's what we need to do and then allowing your people to do the job.
Right.
So that's the fundamental difference between management as a profession and management. You hope the guy's got charisma and smarts and everything else, because maybe he does, but what's right. he going to do with it?
Well, and the difference between the, you know, you hear, I hear it all the time. Are leaders made or are they born?
Right.
Yes and yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think there's certain people that can be naturally great managers. They can't tell you why, but, you know, people do what they want them to do.
Yeah.
But again, what happens when a stressful situation comes up? What happens when things start to fall apart? What happens when a dangerous situation occurs? What do you do? What happens when things are going wrong? So many managers try to manage based on popularity.
Yeah.
And I can tell you one of the most dangerous things you can do is run for homecoming queen when you're trying to be a great manager.
Yeah.
You're going to lose even if there's only one contestant.
What's that? And everybody else feels it, knows it. And you get, now you've got silos in the company polarizing towards the popularity contest of people, and it creates all sorts of challenges.
And it's even more challenging these days. We've never had this level of diversity in the population.
Yeah.
Not only do we have multiple generations, but we have emerging groups. Many people are from out of the country. We have much greater participation by women than we've ever had before. And so if you look at the population, it just absolutely screams for somewhat of a lingua franca, a common language, and that common language has to be the culture, which absolutely has to come first. I love your statement, Steve, that culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Well, that was Peter Drucker.
Was it? Okay.
we borrowed that from Peter.
We quoted a lot. But we're gonna go into a break here, guys. This is excellent discussion today. This is gonna be one of the podcasts I'm gonna re-listen to a lot. There's a lot of notes to be taken. All right, guys, here we go. Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180 AM, your conversation station. We'll be right back.
ExcellentCultures.com is always interviewing leaders committed to cultural leadership, excellence, and change. These leaders, like Russell Freeman, Ross Perot's COO, and Bob Hinton, CPA and Moss Adams Managing Partner, have world-class ideas. As advocates for creating a strong corporate culture that builds people and serves customers with excellence, they share breakthrough business ideas. Gain insights from Russell, Bob, and others on the Culture News blog at excellentcultures.com.
Off-the-cuff management is old school at the very least. With culture at the root of every business problem or success, data-driven strategic leadership is where today's best businesses are focused. No one knows that better than Excellent Cultures. After 35 years, they are the Northwest's premier strategic leadership firm. Excellent Cultures has the expertise to read the soul of your business and generate abundance. Take the free Biz Culture MRI or ask the experts at excellentcultures.com.
Has business taken over your life? Are you living to work or working to live? Stress, broken marriages, neglected relationships, and poor health are symptoms of a life out of balance. The right coaching plan can have transformational impact on the quality of your performance at work, depth of relationships at home, and personal sense of well-being. Ask the experts at Excellent Cultures how coaching can help you maximize your life and optimize your work. Stop struggling to survive. Ask the experts at Excellent Cultures how coaching can help you maximize your life and optimize your work.
So we're back with Charles Herrick. Charles, we could talk about leadership and management all day, and we want to have you back on the show and hear more. But tell us about how that connects with all the books you've written, especially the book you've written on women leaders and women emerging as leaders that we talked about for a second, and how in the world does all of this interact with running 200 meter and 400 meter races and finishing silver medalist for your age group?
Well, that part's kind of an interesting quick story on that one. A friend of mine talked me into running masters track. He was going to do it to lose weight. I looked at it as kind of a fun thing to do. He never put put a foot on the track, and I ended up getting into this thing more and more heavily. And now I have a world-class coach who we're going after a world record, and we've got the World Championships in Brazil coming up in October, and Lord willing, and I don't get injured, well, I have a good shot at getting the gold there. It's kind of interesting to be my age and still being able to run 21, 22 miles an hour, but it's a blessing, and I'm going to keep doing it as long as I can.
I don't think my bicycle goes 21, 22 miles an hour.
Well, I always tell people, you know, hop on a treadmill sometime and set it on 12, and then imagine adding 10 miles an hour to that.
Wow. Your bike goes 22 if you're going down a hill.
Yeah, that's right, going down a hill and coasting and coasting.
But again, it's a fun thing to do.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just going to lead back into the, especially your thoughts on women and leadership and where you're going with that right now and how you came about with that?
Well, yeah, the first book I wrote, which is called A Guide to Managing Earthlings, and again, we really, these are available on my website, charlesherrick.com, but we really haven't made a push for getting these out yet, because I'm just now getting going. I finished up a consulting assignment not too long ago. I was looking at buying out another company, but now I've decided this is the direction I'm going to be going, which is management development, getting my books out there. So the first one was Guide to Managing Earthlings, which again is essentially my reinterpretation of IBM training. Is to focus on what versus how, and how do you become a good leader, CEO all the way down to a first level manager. The other book was called Women in My Office. Really started out as a result of a consulting assignment I had with a woman who had just taken over a company, was not experienced in running a company, and she came to me and said, hey, can you help me get a plan together and kind of give me some coaching on how to run a company? And before when I first sat down with her, it was clearly something else was bothering her. And I said, so what's going on? And she described a situation. I said, well, you know, I used to have a woman that worked for me that had a similar situation. I kind of took her through it, and she felt it was kind of helpful. Similar conversation took place 6 months ago. And after I got done with it, she called me back up and she goes, you know, you really need to write these down. And so I wrote Women in My Office with the idea behind it being I took eight situations, and I described how we work through it with issues that do face women. And they're not all business. I mean, one of them was how to deal with a husband that had betrayed her, and how to deal with certain other issues that were very troubling. And part of the reason, then I've gotten involved in it with women who have as a main thrust in life how to help women develop and strengthen women. And I think it's one of the great advantages that we have as a culture. I gave a speech back in, I think it was 1998, down at the Washington Convention Center, and I had to talk about three future issues, one of which was Japan. And I said, I believe that Japan has an untenable, unsustainable model, that they have cut out 50% of their population, women, from participation, and they just will not have the people in leadership roles and creativity roles that they need to have, and they're going to go down and they're going to stay down until they fix that problem. And so getting women to participate. But also there's kind of the equality movement, which equal opportunity is huge, but trying to say that women do things exactly the same as men, that comes back to the fundamental role that I say that a manager has to play, which is here's what I need to get done. How you go about doing that, because women quite often approach it differently than men. How you go about doing that, what is up to you. I'm here to help. I'm here to provide guidance from time to time, but here's what I need. Here's what it looks like when you succeed, and now you do it the way you're going to do it. Women have a tendency to be much more cooperative. Men have a tendency to work much more in a hierarchical model, and that sometimes works against women. And so the kind of the theme when I'm counseling women is I try to say, you know, you've got to be at some point playing the lead role, the leading lady in your own movie. You can't constantly be playing this support role. You can't constantly be a character actor. And so how do you get into that leading lady role, how do you get to that point where you are the person that's taking this thing forward when you've taken more of a cooperative role all the time? So there are other aspects of it that I think will benefit corporations if they allow women to be as good as they're going to be.
Great. And the name of the book again is?
Women in My Office.
And your website, charlesherrick.com?
Yes.
Wonderful. And then, listeners, if you have a question for Charles, as you can tell, this guy is just not busy at all. He's got plenty of time mm-hmm. on his hands, you know, even though he can write, you know, 10,000.
Yeah.
But if you have a question for Charles, email us at asktheexperts@excellentcultures.com, and we will do our best to get a list to him and get some quality responses back to you.
Yeah.
Charles, give us the name of all the books that you've written now so our listeners can hear it.
Okay. The first book I wrote was Breath of Kenya, and the new version of that is coming out. And that was about the time I spent in Africa. The next book I wrote is another one that has to do with running and kind of some of the issues I dealt with in childhood, was called Purple Boy. And that one should be coming out towards the end of this year. These are available in their pre-release form on my website, but we're not promoting them yet. The management book, which is A Guide to Managing Earthlings, is again available through the website. Women in My Office is what I'm currently going to be pushing and pushing pretty hard.
Yeah.
Because there
it's needed. It's really needed.
Right. There was a woman in St. Louis who's runs a women's organization, is coming out with just a terrific book herself, and she got a hold of the book and asked if she could. At the back, I have 21 rules for women to live better by. And I include actually a bonus rule number 22, which is men never grow up, and how to deal with that.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, but I would say men really don't want to grow up.
No way.
That's why we don't.
That's why we don't.
I mean, we can fake it, but anybody right. has is just dull.
Yeah.
But the rules 1 through 21 were designed for women, and it was... she took that and she asked if she could put that on her blog. And I said, well, wait till the book comes out officially and then we'll do that. One of the things that, when I was talking about some of the advantages that women have, there is one kind of interesting natural advantage that women have that people either say, that's just kind of an old, you know, myth, and women themselves will sometimes go back away from it. And that's the issue of women's intuition. I learned the hard way one time hiring somebody, and a couple of the key women that would normally have been involved in the interview process were not in the loop. And I hired this person, and it was a very high-level position. And first, my secretary comes in to me and says, why'd you hire Ted? And she had this look on her face. And
sorry, Ted, it's now public.
I purposely picked a different name.
Oh, right. Way to get
that. And then another woman came in about a day later, and same question. And then after I explained, I said, oh, he's a great guy, you know, knows his stuff, he's got a track record, on and on and on. She kind of listens, she goes, I don't like him. And sure enough, took 4 months, and we realized this guy's kind of wasn't the right guy from a personality standpoint. They saw something that I didn't see. So I instituted a new rule, we're not gonna hire anybody for any key position without a woman hiring him. So going back to the idea of women's intuition, it is now known as a physiological fact that the blood supply between the two hemispheres of the brain and the nerve supply between the left and right hemisphere is stronger in women than
yes,
it is
it
in
is.
Men.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Okay, so we know that. We know that there's a strong intuitive sense. So now take someone who's got, take a man and woman, she's got the same experience, the same intelligence, and probably a better sense of you know, which way this thing is supposed to go.
And this extra superpower.
You bet. And if you look at the way decisions are supposed to be made, and this is another thing I teach, the way decisions are supposed to be made is not a weighing of the pros and cons. That's the way accounting decisions are made. True decisions are made by having a sense, having a gut feel, and then going to verify it. Now, there are some things that women do that interfere with that process, and it has to do with the approach to priorities and some of the process. you get some of that resolved, and all of a sudden you've got a very, very powerful individual. And I can tell you that a lot of my success, including my last years at IBM and in the future, were as a result of being surrounded by very, very capable women who were allowed to be themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the start of the show, you talked about my wife, Christy.
Yeah.
Christy's a truly wonderful person. She's smart. She's intelligent. She is. There's nobody like Christy. And the reason is Christy was allowed to be herself. We were married so young that we essentially raised each other, and we allowed each other to be who we are. And so you allow people to be as good as they are and who they are, give them some guidance, give them some training, and all of a sudden you got some pretty terrific people that do something pretty good.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. My wife is batting 100%, batting 1,000 on all of the people that I shouldn't have hired, that she told me I shouldn't have hired, you know, either in the hiring process or before the hiring process. So from now on, you know, I don't do anything just but say, honey, what do you think about this person? What do you think about this person? And she hits it every time.
Wow. Well, that, yeah, again, that was one of the reasons that you need to do that. Because, and just from a pragmatic standpoint, look how many decisions are made by women executives now. And you send somebody out that absolutely can't click with women, I think you made a serious mistake.
Yeah, very much so.
That's a challenge, very much so. Leadership. Let's go to a break, and then we want to maybe spend the last half on a couple of questions you might have, Steve.
Yep.
And then there's some good stuff that Charles is moving into in the future with his speaking career and different things that we want to allow him to really elaborate on. So we're going into our last and final break. Today's show is flying by. And remember, send in your questions, ask the experts at excellentcultures.com, and we'll get those answers right back to you. You're listening to Biz Culture Matters, Clay 1180, and on podcast. We'll be right back.
Remember Ross Perot, the Texas millionaire who ran for president in the early 90s? Did you realize that he's built multiple companies that sold for billions? Each of his companies held a strong values-based culture. We interviewed his CFO and COO. His insightful comments on the role of culture in business are posted on the Culture News blog at excellentcultures.com. Take a look. You'll gain wonderful insights to building your own excellent cultures on excellentcultures.com. You can also follow us at XLNT Cultures or Facebook/Excellent Cultures.
Off-the-cuff management is old school at the very least. With culture at the root of every business problem or success, data-driven strategic leadership is where today's best businesses are focused. No one knows that better than Excellent Cultures. After 35 years, they are the Northwest's premier strategic leadership firm. Excellent Cultures has the expertise to read the soul of your business and generate abundance. Take the free Biz Culture MRI or ask the experts at excellentcultures.com.
As an executive, CEO, or business owner, do you find yourself struggling with work-life balance and achieving your goals at work and home? Are you overwhelmed in your workload and feel important things aren't getting done? Our coaches specialize in helping leaders like you overcome challenges and build a plan to recenter their life to achieve the balance and success you've always hoped for in your business and your personal life. Ask the experts at Excellent Cultures about the right plan for you.
So we're back with Charles Herrick on Biz Culture Matters. Charles, you've given us so much information that we got to have you back on the show, because this is enough to capsulize it all, and we will. But what I'd like to hear now, I mean, as you know, this series is about cultures of ethics, values, and employee engagement. And I was just amazed when I listened to all of your description about how you develop leaders, the companies that you've done around, you built around, and that, okay, well, it's just basically the golden rule 101. Tell us your vision for a culture of ethics, values, and employee engagement. What should they look like?
Okay. If you look at the three-way role that almost all companies have to be looking at the world in the right way, a company's customers want to be thinking that that's all the company's thinking about. The employees want to be thinking that the reason the company is there is for them. And the stockholders, the investors, are thinking the same thing. I hope you guys realize that you're in business to be able to provide an effective return. So you've got three people pulling at you. And so how does any one of those become the thing that helps define that culture? And again, going back to IBM, the number one rule was respect for the individual. And they recognized how critically important it was. I think one of the best quotes, and by the way, when you're talking about a culture, how do you get that culture? Is how do you keep that culture once you've got it?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
There's a great quote by Ronald Reagan, which is, freedom is never more than one generation from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children, our bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed to them to do the same, or one day we will spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was like, what it was once like in the United States when men were free. And so the idea of hanging on, building that culture and then hanging on to it.
Yeah.
He made another statement that I think is equally important, which is, putting people first has always been America's secret weapon. It's the way we've kept the spirit of our revolution alive, a spirit that drives us to dream and dare and take great risks for a greater good. So a lot of these companies you'll see start up and everything's just going great and wonderful and people are on fire. What happens? And something wasn't done to keep that culture moving forward. And so you absolutely have to do that. And I will tell you that Lou Gerstner did a wonderful job of taking IBM when it was kind of on its lips, kind of actually on the canvas looking up. And they kind of redid IBM. And again, you had a company that was in every single major account in the world. And, you know, what are you going to do now? And he took the company forward, got it out of its trouble, and it became financially successful once again. There was, however, a change in culture. And the old IBM culture, I believe, went away and never came back. I believe that body is blue. Mm. And I can actually trace it to a time in talking to some of my friends who were there after I left. And they went to a meeting. It was a meeting for managers back in Tarrytown. I guess there were a number of these. But a slide was put up that said, here's the way IBM has always operated. And showed this hierarchy. Individuals, managers, and customers. And he says, we're flipping that over. From now on, our top priority is going to be our customers, our management, which is what drives and leads this thing, and then our people. My position is, even if you believe that, don't say that out loud. Don't be telling your people they're number three.
Right, yeah. Right.
I mean, look, for the last million years, we've been tribal creatures.
Yeah.
Don't tell me we exist for something else.
Yeah.
We exist for us. And oh, by the way, if we want to maintain our position in the tribe, we better do something great for the client and right. something great for the stockholders. But again, it comes down to the people first.
Right.
And you better have managers who think like that.
Yeah.
And you better have managers who do everything they can to breed new people that think like that. So I think that's a critical element of it. I you know, it goes back to Ronald Reagan. I think it goes back to just about every other great leader has recognized how critical the people in your own organization are
yeah.
to your success. And you better have a plan for them. And you better believe it and live it and show up every single day making them feel it as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very well said.
We're at the end of our show.
We didn't even get the last two questions.
You know what? We've got a couple minutes, and I want to spend that last couple minutes allowing Charles to share with us how you're restarting your speaking activities and making more of a career of it, and then what do you plan to talk about, and what do you plan to engage people with?
Okay. There are going to be four different subjects. The first one is women. I've given a little bit of a little picture into what I'm going to try to do there. Women in business and how women can be more successful, how companies can do a better job of taking the tremendous potential of women and using that in such a way that it benefits the company, it benefits the women individually. You know, and I try to address a whole bunch of different issues in doing that. You know, why don't women ask for promotions as often as men? Why do women, end up with more of these supporting roles than the leading roles? And I also focus on, I think, one of the most critical elements, which is what I call unilateral role development, which is regardless of what your role is, whether you're a boss or an employee or a coach or an athlete or whatever, you play your role the very best you can. And then however the other guy does doesn't really matter.
Right.
You still do your job the best. The next subject will be management and management development and how corporations can do better, how corporations can create a real vision and then move in the direction of that, and then all the different things that you have to do. And I talk about a lot of fun things. One of the most interesting things is terrible managers and, how do you deal with people who are managing terrible? The other thing that's really interesting is how do you deal with problem employees? And so there are some really fascinating ways that you can go about doing that. The final two subjects are going to be, I talk about my time in Africa and living in the slums of Bombay and in the high mountains of Kerala. And what one individual can do and how some of that translates over to our daily life here. And I try to answer the question, how is it that a woman in a village who's going to have 6 to 8 kids and only half of those are going to make it to age 5?
Yeah.
Why are they happier than people here?
Right.
The final is just translating world-class athletics into our day-to-day lives.
Yeah.
And that goes for everything from the physiology and the longevity sciences that are now so much more important than they used to be to, how do you show up and do a world-class job in your business?
Absolutely. Thank you for your time.
Sounds like Charles is going to be back for 4 more shows.
I think we need to do 4 more shows. Yeah. I think that's exactly what we need to do in the future. So you can look forward to hearing those on excellentcultures.com in the future, as long as Charles wants to come back.
No, I'd love to.
All right.
We love having
I love it. This was like engaging story to from the beginning of, medical missionary in Kenya to wonderful advice and leadership and management. It's a great show.
Well, just think how much leaders can learn when they learn how to lead instead of manage, or instead of just show up and do what they've always done.
Yep.
And how they can improve when they engage the secret power of women's intuition into their corporate
Absolutely.
Cultures and structures. And gosh, who couldn't learn
from a guy that's been married for 39 years?
Yeah, to the same woman.
Yeah.
and imagine what it's like to integrate all that together into the framework of a world-class high-performance athlete from a performance perspective.
Yeah.
We should do those extra shows now.
Yeah. We don't have time, though. We got to go. So thank you, Charles. And charlesherrick.com. You can get all of their information and book stuff for Charles there. And then, of course, excellentcultures.com, where you'll be hearing this podcast, and Clay 1180 AM. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be with you next week.